And joining us today on Perspectives, the book club, is Steve Barry. Steve is the New York Times bestselling and number one internationally bestselling author of The Cotton Malone Adventures. And there are 11 Cotton Malones in the series. And the latest one involves Cotton Malone. It's the 14th Colony. And of interest to our listeners, perhaps you just joined the book club, but Steve Barry is actually the one who launched the book club without even knowing it. We did an interview with Steve Barry, and all of a sudden it took off. People wanted to do more like that. And so here we are again, and we've interviewed you three or four times now.
Yes, you have.
And so thank you. I mentioned that this is the 11th Cotton Malone adventure. Now, is this the 11th with 14th Colony, or is it 11 plus 14th Colony?
No, this is the 11th.
Okay, so I'm getting a little bit ahead of myself, but we're going to go back. Tell us, Steve, how you got interested in writing. Were you always interested in history and writing, or you just decided to kind of give it a shot?
No, I always had an interest in history going way back to, as far as I can remember, all the way back to early high school. My first adult fiction novel I ever read was Hawaii by James Michener, which, of course, combines history and fiction together, and that's when I got hooked on that combination, and Michener remains my favorite writer of all time. So I've always had that, and when I started writing, I gravitated to things that I love. When I teach writing, I teach all the time, do not write what you know. It's really bad advice. That's terrible advice, actually. Instead, you write what you love. What you know and what you love are the same thing, fine, but for me, it wasn't. You know, I was a lawyer, but I loved action, history, secrets, and conspiracies, and that's what I gravitated towards, and I've sort of carved my little niche out using these things from history and writing modern-day thrillers about them.
You mentioned that James Michener, and of course anybody who's read any of James Michener knows that a James Michener story is not actually a sit-down book and where you read it in a night or a couple of nights, because they're huge. But the fact that he mixes history and nonfiction, fiction, contemporary times, etc. Jeff Shara does the same thing, as I mentioned before the interview started, and he does it a lot with the Civil War and also with World War I and II. How difficult is it to write like this?
Well, it depends on how you want to, where you want to go with it. In my case, I want it to be 90% accurate, and I just want to trip it up about 10%. So it makes it a little more difficult for me because I have to keep things as close to reality as I possibly can and just trip it up enough that your suspension of belief isn't too far, that you can say, well, you know, that makes sense. I can go with that. And that's the niche I've kind of carved out for me. Now, if you write pure historical fiction where you're making it all up, it's a little different situation. You have a lot more latitude there. But for me, it's a little difficult because I have to have all of these things that are real and I have to weave them all together. And then, of course, in the back of the novel, I put the writer's note that tells you where I did trip it up. So it is a bit of a challenge for me.
And at what point do you decide, where am I going to trip it up, where am I not? Because the way you write your narrative and your prose, everything, it just flows so naturally that you don't realize that, wait a minute, maybe this is not true, I need to check on this. And an example is your previous novel, The Patriot Threat, where President Roosevelt is talking to, I just forgot who was this.
Andrew Mellon.
Yes, Andrew Mellon. And they're discussing certain things. And then you told me when we did the interview, that was something that I threw in. But if I had known, it wouldn't have been there.
Well, the meeting itself happened, but what they talked about, I threw in, yes. I added to their conversation, and that's what I did. See, I kept it about 90% accurate. There was an actual meeting. It happened on New Year's Eve, 1936. They talked about the National Gallery of Art. They went through all of that. Then I just added that little twist of mine at the end that sets up the novel. And in the writer's note, I tell you that. So there's a perfect example of where I had about everything that happened in that scene was true, except for the little twist I added at the end of it. And that's sort of, as I said, my niche.
What about Cotton Malone? I mentioned that this is his 11th novel that he is featured in, The 14th Colony, and we'll talk about that in just a minute. But tell us how Cotton Malone was born. How did he come to be? Is it somebody that perhaps you see yourself of part in, or you've heard of someone, or it's your friend, your brother? Tell us how Cotton Malone was born.
Well, he's basically me, is what he is, so it made it easier. I just used my personality and my traits with Cotton. You know, I don't jump out of planes and shoot guns and do all the things that he does.
That's not anymore.
That's sort of my alter ego. But my personality is in him. And he was born in Copenhagen one evening when I was sitting in the Cafe Nordon there eating dinner, and there he was. He just came in my brain. He's going to be Cop Malone. He's going to live right here. His old bookshop's going to be right here on High Broad Plots, right across the square there. And I had this whole vision of him, and that's how the Templar legacy was born, the very first novel where cotton was introduced, and that was in 2006. And he was born around 2004. And he just sort of came to me, and he's evolved now over 11 novels, and now he's back with this one, and his relationship with Cassiopeia is getting back on track, and things are kind of settling down for him, and then he gets tossed into this race against time, basically, because this is the very first novel I've ever done with a ticking clock. It's ticking down to 12 noon on January 20th and ticking down quickly, and the whole novel takes place in the backdrop of that ticking clock.
Are we allowed to say why the clock is ticking, or
would it be
a spoiler?
We wouldn't give anything away.
Okay.
It's ticking down to 12 noon on January 20th, which is the moment when a presidency changes. The Constitution, the 20th Amendment, says that at 12 noon on January 20th, following the election, a president's term ends. There's no extensions. There's no exceptions. It's over at that moment. So the interesting question is, what happens if there's no one there to take the oath? What happens if the president-elect and the vice-president-elect both are dead before they take the oath? There's a huge flaw in our law, a huge flaw in our Constitution that has never been plugged by Congress, and Cotton Malone gets caught up in that.
We are visiting with New York Times bestselling author Steve Berry. His latest novel is The 14th Colony. It's the 11th in the Cotton Malone series, and as Steve just mentioned, this is a very interesting novel because the fact that it's going against the clock, the Cotton Malone is, but why is he going against the clock? Because it's the election time when a president gets sworn in because the old president has his term has expired or he wasn't voted in. But as you just mentioned, Cotton, what happens when the president-elect and the vice president are gone? And it's something that we hope never happens, but at the back of our mind, we're thinking, well, wait a minute. Things have gotten so crazy in this world that we never know.
It is a mess, and that's probably one thing I couldn't give away because that'll give away the novel, but I would say that it is a constitutional and legal mess that the novel explores, and you'll get that answer in the book where I've dealt with that. It's not a clear-cut answer, unfortunately, because the law that governs this is riddled with mistakes. I'll give you a quick example that gives away nothing of the novel. We all know that if a president and a vice president die, the next person in line is the Speaker of the House. And this is where a sitting president and a sitting vice president die, the Speaker is next. We know that. It's clear. Here's the problem. The Constitution forbids a member of Congress from serving as president. It specifically says you cannot do that for separation of powers. So in order to take the oath of office, the Speaker has to first resign his congressional seat. But the moment he resigns his congressional seat, he's no longer speaker, and he's not eligible to be president. And that's exactly how the law is framed. It has a massive flaw in the middle of it that has never been fixed, and it's amazing that Congress has allowed that to stand for 70 years.
One of the things that, well, I'll go ahead and tell the audience a little bit about it, the fact that what happens in this novel is Cotton Malone is shot down over Siberia, and when he thinks that help is coming to get him, it turns out to be somebody else other than help, and all of a sudden he's caught with a former justice from the Russian?
KGB.
KGB, and so it's set up there, and we all of a sudden are faced again with issues of the Cold War, those people who remember the Cold War. But one of the interesting parts here, and correct me if I'm wrong, when I read some of the reviews and other people's takes on the book, Steve, somebody mentioned that they felt like it was President Reagan and the Pope plotting to bring down what used to be the USSR.
Exactly what happened. It was what most historians now agree. The Pope and President Reagan, John Paul II and Reagan, met alone for 50 minutes in the Vatican on June 7th, 1982. It's the only time it's ever happened in history where a Pope and a president met alone. To this day, we have no clue what they talked about, but they specifically wanted to have a private conversation. What we do know is that for the next 6 years, they worked independently of one another to bring the Soviet Union to its knees. And they did a very good 1-2 punch on the Soviet Union. And many historians now believe that there was a tacit agreement between the two of them that they would each use their respective arenas to bring pressure on Moscow and force it into a situation of collapse. And that is exactly what happened at the end of 6 years.
Now, we're living here in El Paso on the New Mexico-Texas border, Mexico border, and White Sands Missile Range is just a stone's throw away. And a lot of people are familiar with the Star Wars program, not the Star Wars trilogy. And this book addresses a little bit of the Star Wars. Am I correct?
Yes. The actual program that was put into place in the 1980s. And again, historians are pretty much in agreement on this. There was no way in the world we were going to build a missile defense shield. It was way beyond the technology of the time, way, way beyond. Most agree that Reagan knew that. But what he wanted was to gather some new technology, pick up some new ideas, and more importantly, he wanted to convince the Soviet Union that it was possible so they would spend money building their own. And that's exactly what happened. They bought it, they were obsessed with it, and they spent billions and billions of rubles that they did not have, and it eventually caused them to implode. Their economy eventually imploded because of that.
We are visiting with New York Times bestselling author, award-winning author Steve Barry. Steve is the author of the latest book, novel The 14th Colony, which is a Cotton Malone series. And Cotton Malone, as you mentioned earlier, Steve, is you on paper and some of the things that you've done and want to do, perhaps what you feel, how you see things. And Cotton Malone is an ex-Justice Department agent, but then he goes to work with an agency. Is it Magellan Agency? Is that what it's called?
The Magellan Billet.
Magellan Billet. Now, I wanted to ask you, because we talked about other authors a little while ago, Clive Barker, who has one of my favorite characters is Isaac Bell, and they deal with the Van Dorn Detective Agency. Because he writes somewhat historical fiction, is the Van Dorn Detective Agency real, like the Pinkerton?
Well, I think it was modeled on that.
Okay.
That's what they did. I think he created his own, which gives you a lot of freedom, by the way. When you create something of your own, model it after a real one, then you can do pretty much whatever you want to with it. In my case, see, that particular series I'm familiar with, that's a pure historical fiction series set in the past. Well, of course, mine's set here in the present with a historical hook, so I need mine to be more historically accurate.
One of the other authors who write period fiction, what he calls, but he also writes historical fiction, is Alan Max Collins. And he has recently written a new one that's coming out in a couple of months. And it deals with the gangster area with Al Capone. And he's written about some of those things. But he talks about how important it is when you're writing something about whatever era it is that you need to be accurate no matter if it's fiction or not. And you just addressed that a little while ago.
Sure, you have to be. You can't just make stuff up. I mean, completely crazy stuff. You've got to, and that's the difficulty of writing things in the past, is that you have to do the research and you have to get all of the details and you have to get those little pieces in there. And I do that. And I even go a step further when I have my characters speak, particularly historical people like Reagan and John Paul, I make sure those words are their words. The entire conversation in the prologue of the 14th Colony, though we don't know what was said at that meeting, are their words said in other places. And I just transported them to that particular conversation.
Something that we spoke about before the interview started, Steve, is the fact that many authors are targeting juveniles, young adults. But the problem is that, at least I see it as a problem, that a lot of those books are littered with F-word and other curse words. And some people say, well, it's not a problem because young adults now are faced with those things. They deal with those things. But you and Jeff Shera, another historical fiction writer, say that that is not needed, and especially if they're going to use the book in school. What is your take on that?
I had one book, my very first novel, The Amber Room, had bad words and sex in it. And I did it there because I'd never done it before, and it happened to be the first novel of mine that got published. It was not the first one I ever wrote. It was the fourth one I wrote. After I wrote The Amber Room, I realized I really didn't need that anymore, so none of my novels have bad words. Maybe an occasional damn or an occasional hell, and that's about as far as I go. I have no sex in any of the novels either. So I've kind of shied away from that, and I'm not doing it from necessarily a moralistic standpoint. It's just that I just didn't think it was necessary to tell the story, and it wasn't it's just not important that my characters say the F word every other time. You can convey their frustration and anger and all those things without having to do that. And I try to go out of my way to make sure that I try not to do that at all. And sex in a thriller to me just gets in the way. It just doesn't fit much and doesn't work in, and certainly doesn't work into my plotting. So those are two things you don't see a lot. You will not see a lot in my books.
When, of course, you are already an established author, but did you at any point get approached by any of your contemporaries or any of your colleagues or publishers who said, hey, Steve, you know, you might want to try it this way?
No, not really. I mean, you talk about trying it this way, meaning the way I write or the...
Trying to change from the way you write to...
No, I haven't had that. I've never had anyone try to change the way I write. We talk story all the time where they want to change stories and make suggestions to how the story should be in there. But no, I've never had that really. I've had two editors in my 14 years now, and both of them let me be me, but they added their little spice and little accents to it.
Things that have changed are continuing to change. I teach a voice acting and announcing class, and my students were... I was trying to get them to tell me about perhaps one of their favorite audiobooks, but as I found out that a lot of them don't listen to audiobooks and they don't read books, but they watch the movie. And so tell me, how did you go about selecting Scott Brick for your narration on your books? He does an excellent job.
Yeah, I picked him years ago because I just like his books. When I used to practice law, a courthouse was 22 miles away from my office, so I drove a lot because I would be up there. I'd probably go to that courthouse back and forth four or five times a week at least, sometimes more. And I listened to audiobooks an awful lot. That was sort of my reading, was listening to audiobooks. And I always loved Scott's stuff. So when I got a chance to get published and I had my own audiobooks, I wanted him to do it. And he's done all of mine since Alexandria Link. He did the Amber Room. He's done all of mine, but... Three books he did not do in the beginning, but he does a superb job. I love to listen to the audio because I always like to hear what he does with the foreign words that I don't pronounce very well. I like to hear how he says them.
And we've gone from listening to someone read a book to someone dramatize a book, and that makes it even more exciting.
Yeah, we're getting a little more of that today, and particularly the good narrators do add an element of drama to it. And I like the way he does it, and just he's always just done first class, and I've listened to the 14th Colony audio, and it's really, really well done. Some of you readers may know last book we did something unusual called the Writer's Cut, where I came in at the end of the chapters and added a little bit to the narration. We did not do that this year. We're going to do it again next year, though.
Tell me a little bit about, because we're taping this in March of 2016, and a presidential election is still, you know, a ways away, but not that far away. Yet here comes a book that is very timely, at least on the way when we're doing the interview, talking about a possible president-elect president, what's going on in the world, the Pope. The Pope just visited the El Paso Juarez area not too long ago. How do you come about, or does your publicist tell you what to write next or how to go? How do you decide what period of history you're going to go to?
I choose that myself, and I make that call, and I intentionally decided that I wanted to do a book dealing with the presidency this year for obvious reasons, because it would be hot on everyone's mind. So I picked that subject matter intentionally and factored it in for 2016. And I picked that subject matter about 3 years ago, so I knew it was going to come this year, because you stay a year ahead in the book business. So the 14th Colony was actually written in 2014, turned in 2015 for publication in 2016. So it's 2 years behind. So I make those calls and decisions, and I'm hoping it's going to be timely. I hope people are going to like it.
We are visiting with New York Times bestselling author, award-winning author, Steve Barry. Steve is the author of the latest novel, The 14th Colony, the 11th in the Cotton Malone series. Is there a period of history that you haven't touched upon? And another question is, and this may be tied in, do you have specific areas of history that you want to touch upon on all your novels, in all your novels?
I've been across the board so far. I've done ancient, modern, medieval. I mean, I kind of like it all. I really don't have a particular favorite. I just try to find an area of history that interests me at that moment in time, something from the past that's fascinating, something that will definitely interest the reader. And then occasionally, like when a current affair kicks in, like a presidential election, I try to see if I can find something that will fit that particular thing that's going to be very hot and topical for that year. And I was lucky here that I had a presidential story, and so I just held it for a couple of years until it was timely. So I look for those stories, and I search for them. They're getting harder to find, but thank goodness I'm okay for at least the next 4 or 5 years.
That's good, because hopefully I'll be around for the next 4 or 5 years to read some of your books. Since you mentioned the history and the fact that you've always been interested in history, I want to take the time here to let our audience know that you and your wife are involved in a very important organization, foundation, that deals with your books and some of the other things that are featured in your books. But I don't want to give it all away. I want you to tell me a little bit about what you and your wife are doing.
We created a foundation 6, 7 years ago now called History Matters. And we go around and help communities raise money for historic preservation. And we do it through a lot of ways. On the book tour this year, we did a couple of them, one in Albany and one in Tulsa, Oklahoma. We did a meet and greet where you bought a ticket, and I did a talk and question and answers and interacting. And all of the money from that event that night went to a particular project. I taught a writer's workshop in Albany, New York. That's where we do a lot of our money raising, where Elizabeth and I teach a 4-hour workshop on the craft of writing, and you buy your way in with a contribution, and then all of that money goes to the project that we're there for, too. We never charge expenses. We never charge anything to come. In fact, we pay our own way to go to these. So far, we've raised nearly $1 million for various projects around the country.
And how do you find out about what are some of the things that perhaps are up for auction or that some people are interested in?
They contact us, the particular area. In this case, the Historical Society up in Albany got in touch with us, and the same in Tulsa, and said that they would like to do a History Matters project. And then we start working with them. They take many months to plan and put together, and we try to do around 4 or 5 a year is what we do now.
And there are a lot of situations where authors go and visit people, children's in hospital, students, parents. Well, you got involved in something about dealing with our men and women who are fighting abroad and serving abroad.
Yes, I did. I was very fortunate that I got to go on a USO trip to Iraq. This is when the war was still going on about 6 years ago. And we were the very first contingent of thriller writers. There were 5 of us that went on this USO tour. We spent 10 days in Iraq going to seeing the bases and interacting with the troops. It was quite remarkable. Reading is one of the number one recreational activities that was over there. Reading was very big. And they were glad to see writers come. And it was an amazing experience, one I will never forget.
When you mentioned that you and Elizabeth, your wife, in part of the History Matters, and you also hold workshop conferences to help people to craft their writing or learn how to write, a lot of times, sometimes a would-be writer or they are a writer, and they're afraid, perhaps, a little bit intimidated that they're going to, because some teachers, when they've gone to some conferences, they'll say, well, you know, I thought it was going to be very enjoyable, but then it turns out that this person was just slamming me and just kind of promoting his own work or her own work. And, of course, I don't expect that from what I know of you, but do you ever kind of find that some people are a little bit intimidated to show their work?
Not at all. Just the opposite of that. Our workshops are very open and very interactive. Everyone who's ever, we've had over 3,000 students take the workshops. I've never had anyone say it was a bad experience for them. I've never had anyone, we hand out forms at the end because we'd like to get their comments on what they think of the workshop so we can change it or modify it. And this is really weird. I mean, and I'm just telling you a fact here. I have never read a single comment form that had a negative experience on it. They all left there just mesmerized and energized and ready to get home and ready to get back to work. I try to convey that enthusiasm to them. I definitely agree with you. I do not make the workshop about me. It is not about me at all, except I tell you all of the bad things I've done because I've made every mistake writing a human being can make. So I'm a good example for what you should not do in some respects, and I use myself in those examples. But it's not about me. It's about them, and we try to stimulate them and get them ready to go so they will go home and write and not quit. You got to remember that 90% of all writers do not finish what they start. And my goal is to bring that way down from 90%.
We are visiting with New York Times bestselling author, award-winning author, Steve Barry. Steve is the author of the recent novel, The 14th Colony, and this is the 11th Cotton Malone novel, where Cotton Malone is featured. And basically, just to set it up, this is a very important novel for Cotton Malone, for an adventure, because he is out racing against the clock, and that clock is noon on January 20th, correct? 20th, when our new president gets sworn in. But there are other things happening, and so we're not going to give it away. And Steve told a little bit about it, but we will let you know that it involves a little bit of President Reagan visiting with Pope John Paul. And that happened, that event did happen, because as Steve mentioned, he writes historical fiction, but 90% of it is historical. And he just, I forgot the word that you used a little while ago, hype it up, timed it up, write it up, something up, and it made a lot of sense. But
oh, yeah, you talk about, from the standpoint of what you write?
Yes. Write it up.
Yeah, you write what you write what you love. You get in there and you write what you love. And this is the kind of stuff that I love.
And for the benefit of our younger listeners, are some of your books made into young adult versions?
No, I've not done into that genre. I don't know much about that genre. I don't really read it very much, so I don't have that. I do have a lot of young adult readers, though. I have a lot of readers. My books are pretty good from about 16 on, you'd have no problem with. They're not, you know, they're not heavy reads, but they're not light reads either. But I have a lot of young readers. I get emails from them all the time, a lot of high school students who love the novels.
And a lot of the young students are very social media savvy, so Facebook is very important. Steve, you have a Facebook page?
We do. We have a Facebook fan page, which you can go to. And we have a website, steveberry.org, which has everything on it about me and the books.
And the Facebook page, all they need to do is just put Facebook and then Steve Barry author?
Just put Steve Barry writer and author in there, and it'll go right to it, sure.
Well, Steve, thank you so much for being with us, and I'm looking forward to reading your next novel. Like you mentioned before, it's already written. We won't see anything until next year.
Next year. New Cotton Malone adventure, and you're going to find out finally how Cotton got his name.
Oh, and you know what? That is the name of our building that our department is, Cotton Memorial Building.
Ah, well, you're going to find out how he got his name in the 2017 novel. It's a really fun story that deals with the Smithsonian Institution.
The beginning of the Smithsonian?
A little bit of that, yep, back in the 19th century, but it's a mystery that revolves around the Smithsonian. I serve on the Smithsonian Libraries Board, so I have a lot of involvement with the Smithsonian, and so I've been wanting to work it into a novel, so next year is it.
Well, great. Thank you, Steve, again, for taking the time to be with us. We know you're very busy, but we enjoy talking with us, and again, thanks for launching the book club here on KTEP. We've been visiting with New York Times bestselling author and award-winning author Steve Barry. Latest novel is a Cotton Malone series, 11th one, The 14th Colony. Thank you, Steve, for being with us.
Oh, great to have. Thanks for having me.
Perspectives is taped and produced at the KTEP Studios, University of Texas at El Paso Communication Building. Our thanks to our engineer, Evan Walsh. Our producer is Dennis Wu. You've been tuned to Perspectives. I'm Louis Sines.